And welcome back to another episode of The Conspiracy Skeptic. I'm your conspiracy skeptic, Carl Maimer. And I swear I am not switching formats, but I have Dr. Pearl Mutter and Julie. I have Julie Brennan. I have you back. Last time you were on, we were talking about Pluribus Season 1. Now we're talking about a Oscar-nominated film called Begonia.
Yes.
Yeah.
But did you want me to just jump in, or?
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, the reason we're kind of doing this is the Dr. Perlmutter, and is it okay, Dr. Perlmutter? We can call you David. Is that okay?
Always, yeah.
Okay. All right then. Yeah. So Julie.
I mean, the alien mothership did give me permission to talk with humans in a normal human way. So please go ahead.
Good. Okay. Yeah. Julie, special dispensation. You may call Dr. Perlmutter David, but just like we're in the very center of the Pentagon. We're in that little area. No one has to salute anybody. So I don't know if that's true, but I read that once you're in that little center of the Pentagon, no one has to salute anybody. So yeah. All righties. Okay. Yeah. All right. So yeah. So Begonia, David, Dr. Perlmutter, he messaged me and he's like, this has got a lot of touch points, you know, with modern conspiracy culture. Let's talk about it. And I'm like, sounds great. So Julie, what, you know, brief overview. Oh, I should point out, we are going to spoil this like crazy. So if you've not seen the movie and you want to kind of enjoy the, you know, the twists and turns and which way it's going, then don't listen to this podcast. Go see, it's on Prime, at least on Prime Canada. Go catch it on Prime, watch it, go get a pizza, spend time with your family, then come back and listen to the podcast. So something in that order. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Okay. Now that you have all been warned, Julie, well, yeah, just the overview, what is this movie basically about?
So the way that I explained it whenever I roped my partner into watching it with me was it's two conspiracy theorists, which I realized whenever I told him that after I watched the movie, that's not quite right, but a conspiracy theorist and his colleague kidnap a CEO of a pharmaceutical company that has wronged them under the idea that she is an alien overlord or alien being of some kind. And it turns out they're right. There's the conspiracy is that there is no conspiracy there. They were right the whole time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that was kind of the big twist. Now I will say, maybe you guys can, or like me, but I was watching it and by about a third of the way through, I'm like, she's a real alien. That's going to be the big twist, right? You know, but I will say there's a scene where it's like, you know, you're kind of going, yeah, she's an alien. And then there's a scene, and we'll get to that, where she's like, no, I'm really an alien. And then you're like, yeah, that's what I thought. But then there's another little scene near the end where you're like, oh, no, I think maybe she's a human. She's just playing like cool cucumber. But then, no, she was an alien. So, yeah. But all right. So, yeah. Yeah. So basically it revolves most of the movie is basically Teddy, who is like your classic conspiracy theorist.
Radicalized.
Exactly.
The internet.
Yeah. And radicalized in the traditional way, kind of like, you know, listens to podcasts, watches YouTube videos I should say the director is
Yorgos.
Will Tracy. Director's Will. Tracy. Yeah, Will Tracy. He sorry, no. Sorry, he's the writer. Sorry, not the director. He was the writer. But what I find, yeah, the it's interesting that the writer of this, he was actually editor in chief of The Onion. So, oh, yeah,
I which, didn't realize that.
Yeah, and which one? There, the film is kind of funny, but not like you know, not like a Jack Black film kind
right.
of funny. Yeah,
the parts that stood out to me as funny, honestly, were the things like there was the Tarantino amount of blood.
Yeah,
when again, spoiler, Don takes his life. That was. It was so shocking, and I'm so glad that he went over the top with that visual, because yeah. I think I would have had to have tuned out if they had tried to go more realistic. Yeah. But then the music also was it would always be like so over the top, so dramatic at these great like comedic stops, and it cracked me up. So
yeah. Yeah, exactly. But so, yeah, so that is editor-in-chief of The Onion. He's very in touch. Obviously, you'd be very in touch with modern conspiracy culture, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry, David.
No, I just the part about it being comedic was very interesting to me, because on the internet, on YouTube, you can see people who have recut trailers of comedies to make them look like dark, deep, thoughtful thrillers, and then the other way around. And I was thinking, if you could have done a trailer of this, and I went earlier today and watched a couple of the trailers and the teaser, and there's so many moments like, okay, the kid, the CEO who's of this company that makes different products, but including pesticides, I believe, and chemicals,
right.
Is being kidnapped by the two most incompetent kidnappers that have ever actually successfully pulled off a kidnapping, in terms of like they're just, but visually, especially the long shots of people fighting with like huge gestures, it looks like a madcap romp comedy just in the visual of it. I mean, it could have been you know, something from the Keystone Cops, if anybody at least remembers the meme of that, or some physical wealth. Like, this could have been a Will Ferrell film very easily.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, when the screenplay was first written, I could imagine a studio head going like, okay, let's cast Will Ferrell as the kidnapper and let's make it a really dark, but like madcap romp comedy.
Yeah.
But it isn't.
It's funny you say that, because one of the ones that I remember the most is turning The Shining into a rom-com from the trailer. And so that's funny, because I kept feeling like so many of those shots were very Kubrick, like Stanley Kubrick style shots. So I wonder if that was intentional. But anyway, that was just something I noticed that I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first act of the movie is kind of where, you know, kind of sets up the character, sets up, you know, why they are, who they're trying to kidnap, why they're trying to kidnap her. So it kind of, but it kind of splits between the lives of, I think it's set in Georgia, the lives of two, not wealthy young guys, and how they're kind of planning and preparing for this kidnapping of this very wealthy CEO. And then you see her life. She lives in the absolute lap of luxury, massive house. She drives a Mercedes G-Wagon, which mm-hmm. I only know the name because this is my wife's. Like, if we ever win like a major lottery, and it has to be a major lottery, she wants a G-Wagon. And this is, these things are like, you know, you need to win one lottery to buy the damn thing, and you need to win another lottery just to afford maintenance. So this is how expensive. Right. Yeah. So, you know, and they're, and so they're able to kind of like kind of kidnap her. But as David, as you're sort of saying, it sort of sets up that that she is the CEO of a pharmaceutical chemical company, but and their products are poisoning the world, and he's also a beekeeper, and it's he believes she is responsible, her company's responsible for the colony collapse disorder. And but not only that, she's possibly a high-ranking space alien from, I gotta do some space, from the galaxy Andromeda. You know, so very, let me try Andromeda. You know, so very kind of 50s, you know, like which is kind of just makes it very goofy. Like, conspiracy theorists are never like, yeah, they're just coming from the star over. No, this is like a whole galaxy is coming to get us kind of thing. Yeah. So that was kind of
this is like a real conspiracy that exists out there, and so it's like there's a whole lot that I'm sure people can read into this.
Yeah, exactly. So
I just wanted to mention her. I think it's very important that we do have sort of a montage, and the movie takes time to introduce us to these characters. Mm-hmm. She's not just a CEO number 12. Like we learn a certain amount about her. Like, for example, we see her training with a martial arts instructor, and she's really acquitting herself. She's played by Emma Stone, fantastic actress, and also an extremely gifted physical comedian. She was in La La Land. She was in a lot of comedies before she did some drama roles. She's been on Saturday Night Live. She's one of those actors who can pull off any role, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And so she's introduced as, first of all, highly intelligent, like super off the chart smart, very corporate. Like she's always saying with this conviction these corporate buzzwords and slogans, like there's this whole little interplay there, like, we don't want anybody to, you know, not have a family life, and so you can go home at 5 unless you really have important work to do, and then you could stay a little longer. Then, and she has to re-explain,
we do need to meet our quotas.
Yeah
exactly.
So she is, and then she's introduced as very physically capable. So this is not a, you know, 200-pound overweight, too many lunches, too many martinis, you know, 75-year-old CEO. This is somebody who is set up as extremely capable, intelligent. So you both were much picked up on things faster than me. I kept thinking, I mean, there's no way the ending could have been any different, in the sense that the audience would not have been happy if it turned out she was just the CEO and these were just crazy people. Right. I don't think that would have been an acceptable ending for this movie narratively. But I don't think you really can tell, because everything that she does, including admitting she's an alien, until it turns out like she actually goes up to a spaceship.
Yeah. Yes. That goes back to her corporate doublespeak.
That's right.
And like that just continues to echo throughout all of what she does. And I'll try to not get into it, but there's some aspects of her that I haven't really heard anybody else really talking about, where she's like, she talks a lot about how bad humanity is, but, you know, how much better is she? Where she's spending all of this time, you know, getting to do the red light treatment. But you have her own employees have injuries from the equipment that they're too scared to go get help for. Like, what a contrast. Yes,
exactly. I mean, that's kind of the thing, right? That she it's later revealed that she's just not an alien. She's actually the emperor. And, you know, Teddy, the main conspiracy in
chief. She's a leading alien. She's not the emperor herself.
No, she is the emperor. The emperor. Yeah.
Whenever she comes back up through, they help her up.
Yeah.
They introduce her as the emperor.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I thought was also
interesting. I read it differently, but let's get there. I apologize.
Yeah, okay, no, I thought, no worries.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So, but two things. You guys in academia. I'm coming more from like corporate world, and the leave at five. It was leave at 5:35. Very specific, you know, not like leave at 5:30. Leave at five. Leave at you can leave at 5:35, unless you know, which. My job one day, you know, we all had like 4 weeks vacation, and then one day they're like, hey, greatest thing in the world, unlimited vacation. We all got unlimited vacation. But as it begins to more to play out, it's like, okay, well, can I just take every Friday off every week? No. Yeah. You know, well, you know, you got to use your conscience and your sense of, and, you know, manager. And then as it turned out, unlimited vacation was really your 4 weeks. But previously, if you accrued your 4 weeks then and you quit or we laid you off, we had to pay you those 4 weeks out. Now we only have to pay you the legally mandated 2 weeks. So, you know, I mean, it's that, it just reminded me of that kind of thing. And then the cubicles. Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Where I'm sure that they had that information like written out in a employee handbook or something, mm-hmm. but when it's already not part of the culture, it's like,
yeah,
just icky. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And the one thing that struck me, too, is like, you know, she's walking by all these cubicles, and they're all glass, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one of the ideas of, you know, cubicles was they always provide you a little bit of privacy, right? But, you know, when it's a glass cubicle, it's like, why? Why? I mean, other than, you know, they're now sneeze guards or something like that, you know? It's like... I thought that was kind of funny. Yeah. So she's like, she good, not great human being, alien pretending to be a human being, but yeah, as an alien who's there to, as we later find out, who's there to kind of basically much like, the day the earth stood still, you know, they're there mm-hmm. to judge the earth and destroy the earth. And unless they're given a good reason not to be destroyed and stuff like that, you know, she's kind of, and she admits later that, you know, herself has fallen into, she's gotten too greedy and she's enjoyed the pleasures. And I got to come back to, like I was last show, come back to David Bowie's The Man Who Fell to Earth. Again, similar kind of concept, right? About an alien who comes to Earth to kind of save his own world and just becomes taken away by the carnal pleasures of,
which,
you know.
Was interesting because she, right, like she explained that humans became cruel because they tried to create other humans.
Yeah.
And then they had, you know, devolved into apes and things like that. And so. But so she says that, but then she also says that just by her proximity to humanity, she's become crueler. And I think
Eddie, who's they set him up to be like a really good conspiracy theorist archetype. You know, he's David. Or some of the kind of the like. How does he sort of embody the conspiracy, the classic modern day conspiracy theorist?
Yeah. Well, Carl, you and I did a show a while back where I lamented that we were in the era of low effort conspiracy theories, right?
Yeah.
Like people just read a headline on Reddit and then that was it. That was their entire work to decide that Andromedans, I want to go back to that pronunciation of in the movie Andromedans.
Yeah.
Now, that I think that's a piece of evidence to talk about. But this guy, he is an A+, old fashioned, high effort conspiracy theorist. Like you can tell from like there's papers he's been looking. I mean, I think he spent years mm-hmm. digging into this. His mother obviously was a strong influence. I mean, it, again, sometimes I see things in the film and, or miss things, but I read that his mother was a conspiracy theorist yes. and bequeathed that to him.
I had read that there was a cut scene that was one of the flashback scenes, the black and white scenes, where she was like covering him in tinfoil to keep his thoughts safe from the aliens.
Right.
That's what I heard. So it was meant that she was supposed to be the influence here.
But he did a deep dive. And then, I mean, I guess we can say this on a family radio show. He goes further than any conspiracy theorist I've ever heard of in that he has apparently chemically castrated himself.
Yes.
And he chemically castrates
his cousin, Don.
His cousin, Don, who we should say is played incredibly well by an actor who happens to have is openly talking has talked about his own autism and on the spectrum, and is just a fantastic performance as this loyal, loving, and sort of innocent.
Yeah, who's,
you know, being
he's the only going moral along. Character.
He's the only person in the film you feel I personally felt any like sorry for. You know. But anyway, you're absolutely right, Carl. This guy is classic in the 1950s, 60s sense, except with the internet of like covering every base of conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a scene where they chemically castrate each other. As I think as Teddy says, he protect them from the biological imperative. So, which maybe means, you know, they don't want her to seduce them or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I'm reminded of a Heaven's Gate, right? You know, the Heaven's Gate people, that was something they did, right? I think they might have first chemically castrated themselves and then they actually, sorry, they I'm doing a little... Out. I'm doing a little scissor motion. I'm very sorry, Julie, I'm going to kind of be a little creepy, but there's this whole like branch of very red pill conspiracy. They call themselves no wanks.
Oh yeah.
I won't go into detail, but yeah, and they kind of
it's not like cults in general will control sexual activity. It's all just a form of control, whether it's somebody over you or you over yourself or whatever you think the control is.
Exactly. And yeah, perfect. Yes. And that is exactly kind of another thing they kind of like, they're not dog walking it to each thing, but they're just putting in little things that, you know, that, that's Heaven's Gate. And, you know, where they're cutting their hair, you know, they cut her hair. They don't cut their own hair, but they cut her hair. But again, cutting the hair of junior people you're bringing into your cult is, you know, Hare Krishnas and things like that. Very, very common. Right. So.
And then that ends up actually being like, that's the one detail that's correct is the hair being their, how they communicate.
Oh yeah, exactly. As well, I mean, in sort of a lot of conspiracy types, right. You know, like Teddy is upset at a world just collapsing, what appears to him to be a world collapsing around him. He works a very shitty job, a very Amazon-like job, but it is basically the mailroom for the company he thinks is destroying the world. And go ahead.
And he even, we hear him talking to his coworker about the OSHA violation, which...
Yeah.
Injured her hand, and he's encouraging her to do something about it.
Exactly. And it's very typical of conspiracy people to not go like, okay, you know, it is just it's a whole lot of everything that is it is kind of running the world down. But to a conspiracy person, it's like they find one thing, you know, this is the problem. Yeah. And if I take out, if I take out Michelle, the head of this company, then the world will be so much better, you know, which again, that's very classic conspiracy theorist.
Well, and yeah, it's funny how the film like has us a whole lot more sympathetic to Teddy, even as his conspiracy theorists, some of them start to lean more towards the over the top and dramatic. And so that's when you start to lose faith in him, but that you build so much sympathy because he is that mailroom blue collar worker. And it's harder, it's at least in this decade, to have that kind of sympathy for Michelle. And I thought that was an interesting aspect of making us more sympathetic to the conspiracy theorist.
I wonder about so suppose you were describing the plot of this film to somebody who hadn't seen it and say, these two guys kidnap a woman, knock her unconscious, shave her head, beat her, starve her.
Torture her
because they think that she's an alien. At no point, I understand what you're saying, Julie, and I agree. And I think the film is sort of making a subtext comment about how our sympathies can be manipulated. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Because that description I just gave, if somebody said, and you know, I kind of sympathized with the person who was doing this to the woman, you'd go like, what, you horrible person?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And I would say that if somebody described that way.
Well, whenever
but obviously the filmmaker was trying to play the whole way along with who we were supposed to be or we wanted to sympathize with.
Right. Whenever you first introduced this for us to watch, for us to talk about, I went and read about that and saw the a woman being tortured. And I was like, he said it, this is one of the most disturbing films for him. And it says it's a dark comedy, but then this is how it's described. So I don't know. So it took me a little bit to be okay with watching it. But
I think that's a good segue into Act Two. So they've, you know, they sort of bumble their way through capturing her. They shave her head in her G-Wagon. They ditch that, get her back to their house, which is the house his mother owned. He's living there now with his cousin Dawn. And it is revealed, too, that Michelle and the company, they had given his mother some kind of drug that did terrible things to her, and then
she had an opioid addiction, and they were trying to it was an experimental drug to help cure her of that addiction.
Exactly, which was kind of the cover story, but as we find out later.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll get more into what the real thing was. But we're getting kind of some parallels with the mRNA virus and, that kind of thing, the drug companies and stuff like that. But they give him a settlement.
Yes.
And so he has put her in the basement, as all these people would do, chain her down in the basement. And there are very few tells when you rewatch it. You're rewatching it a second time, and you're looking for any tell that she's a space alien. And to me, the only two things is when she's brushing her teeth in the morning, she's just looking into the mirror in this very dead, she's got no expression on her face, and I'm like, okay, that's a little. And you know, when she wakes up, you know, after being kidnapped. They drug her to like knock her unconsciousness, and when she kind of wakes up, she's not hysterical, not freaked out. You know, like I think we would all be, right? We're chained to a dirty mattress in some weirdo's basement, and I mean, they do everything except bring out, you know, two banjos and start doing banjos in front of her, right? You know, I think so. It's like,
Carl, doesn't that speak though to her being set up as being highly capable? Because her entire interaction, again, I knew from the very beginning, because I just didn't see how any other resolution of the plot could be that she wasn't actually an alien. I just didn't know how they could pull off any other plot reveal except she's an alien. But she is so good at corporate. And I'm thinking, like, you know, somebody in her position, they would have had a discussion like, you know, if you're kidnapped, you know, try to win over the kidnappers. Actually, that's in, for those who are old enough to remember it, in The Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
One of the victims that the FBI mentions about how, you know, if you're kidnapped, you have to try to humanize yourself to there. And that actually occurs as a subplot in Silence of the Lambs. So very early on, she's going by the, I was kidnapped, all I have is my brains here, I'm going to get out of this by manipulating them. And she's directing, she sees Dawn as the cousin as the weak one, like like she can, with more sympathy, less fanaticism. So just to me, that was one of those things where, yes, it could be retroactively, well, she was an alien, but it also could be she was just really smart and knew what to do in that situation.
I mean, because she does that. She tries to negotiate with him, and then she tries kind of psychology with him, like, you know, you're in an echo chamber, you know, you're getting this all wrong. She tries to then, yes, I am an alien. He doesn't believe her. I mean, she's doing a bunch of tricks, true, but, you know, there should have been some point where, you know, she cracks, right? Like, I think as any human being would crack, but she does not crack, so which leads me to believe maybe a feature of these aliens is they don't have, you know, Dawn is autistic, right? And but they never say he's autistic, but you just know there's something off about Dawn, and he's just very childlike and trusting, and it's also very how the conspiracy people kind of call it red pill, you know, pill the you know, the kind of the innocent and stuff like that. So they bring her to the basement, and then Dawn, you know, Dawn's a bit like the, like, well, they always say the Doctor Who companion, you know, sometimes the Doctor Who companion, you know, her job is to go like, ew, doctor, what is it?
Yeah.
You know, and then Doctor Who can go, well, there's a, you know, a dragon master from Trocken 3, and, you know, and then so Dawn is a bit of
out that way, but he ends up being more of a conscience.
Yes. He's like the moral center of a very fucked up kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
exactly right, at least in my reading, is that, yeah, absolutely, he's a Dr. Watson character, like, oh, Holmes, I don't quite understand the bee conspiracy, explain it to me. But on the other hand, like, seven times that I counted, he says something which is like the good question at this moment, like, you know, should we really be beating this woman? Or, wait, you know, Cousin Teddy, I love you, but that sounds a little wild. Are you sure about that? So, so to some extent, he's the host of the Skeptic Talk Show, asking some of the questions that we would about, and you have in your books about conspiracies. Yeah. And it's interesting they make that kind of a person the almost the only sensible person in the entire movie.
Yeah. But, well, the one thing I kind of liked is there's a scene where Dawn, the cousin who is sort of autistic, he asks Teddy, he's like, well, how do you know she's an alien? And then he's like, oh, you can tell. And they're showing her feet, and you're just like, But then he says, you know, they give signs on their Instagram, which is, again, that is classic conspiracy. Like, you know, Beyonce, you know, she's Illuminati. she's doing this triangle thing with her hands, or the way she's, you know, they're doing these things with their hand. That's a sign. Right. So I'm like, another, you know, we're playing conspiracy theorist bingo with this.
This movie.
Yeah.
No, that cracked me up. It was the code all over your Instagram. It was you're barely trying to hide it. Yeah. That made me laugh because it always the I have this knowledge, somehow I have this knowledge and you don't aspect of the conspiracy theorist that I thought was interesting and played really well.
Exactly. So
that's a key there. And you were mentioning before a missing scene, Julie, and I really expected there to be a scene later when there was a reveal that this is an alien and say, and by the way, we've been testing you humans. We keep revealing in our Instagram and social media, you know, secret signs that we're Andromedans. And you guys have never noticed, ergo you're idiots, right? I just felt that scene was coming and it never came. So I don't know whether it's on the cutting room floor somewhere.
Right.
Yeah. But there's a scene. I think when they get all dressed up, right? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. as the best they can to, you know, because they think she's
after the torture.
Yeah, they think she's kind of a high-ranking alien, and they get kind of dressed up, and then he kind of sits down, and they bring in another conspiracy thing where he reads her kind of like Miranda rights, like this weird little legalese, which again is right of kind of like sovereign citizens or what we might call in Canada. Oh, yeah. Freeman on the land, like that he reads her this legal pseudo code, you know, like as if, okay, we got to do this by the, you know, torture you by the book. And so they
need the convention because of the humanist aspects that they aspire to or whatever that line was.
Exactly. But then this is really the most difficult scene, and it triggered me in real life, which I would like to talk about, but where they wire her up, put electrodes all over her, and he has to kind of like test her pain responses, horrible torture, and that determines is she an alien, and more pain she can tolerate, apparently higher she up is in the hierarchy, and so I'm watching this, and because I've had health problems, like my spine is sort of going, my left sciatic nerve is going, I'm just going to cut you out of Carl's life kind of thing. So I've had to go through this thing called an EMG, which I don't even know what it stands for, but they basically put electrodes from the waist down, and not to get weird, but in some very intimate places. They fucking shock you with electricity. Yeah. And it starts off like, you know, that incredibly painful thing, that was level one. We're going to move to level two now. And it's just like, it keeps getting worse and worse. And then it goes on for 30 minutes. And then they do it again on the other leg. You know, it's just so.
And Carl, you would have admitted to anything at the end of. That, right.
Oh, no, exactly. Exactly. I'd be like, well, I've been going through like MRIs and CT scans and X-rays and blood tests, and I keep going to myself. Is this procedure I'm going through, is it better than the It's a Small World ride at Disney World, or is it worse? And the EMG thing, I'm like, this is worse than, you know, this is how I kind of keep saying when I'm like, they've strapped my face into an MRI. You know, I go, okay, this is, no, I still would rather be doing this than being on It's a Small World ride with my grandmother. I don't know. So, yeah. A very incredibly difficult scene to watch, but you never see her. But Teddy.
You hear the screaming.
Yeah, the screaming.
Intense.
Teddy's crazy, and so they release her, and then suddenly Teddy's whole thing changed, and he's like, "Your Eminence," you know, like, and then they let her out of the basement and kind of bring her upstairs. And then not to be free. Well, they let her shower and stuff. And then, but then they kind of more like chain her to a chair. So, you know.
Yeah.
But there's another great scene. Yeah.
They give her Teddy's mom's dress to wear.
Yes. Right. Exactly. And
that's where she starts to connect everything.
Exactly. Yeah. This is Teddy's. This is his mother that we were sued and paid a settlement. And. There's another little thing we're going on with the classic conspiracy theorists where they're putting tinfoil on the windows. So, again, that was a nice little callback to.
Since they had to cut the scene where Sandy Gatz covered Teddy with tinfoil, they had to work tinfoil in somehow. Yes,
you did get a tinfoil scene. So, yeah. So, they're, So, he kind of. He makes her a spaghetti dinner.
That's the fanciest thing that he knows.
Exactly. And I'm just, the way Michelle looked when she's trying to eat that dinner is exactly the way my wife looks when I've made her dinner. So I'm like, could I chain my wife to the chair? And then, you know, she has to... you know, eat it and then just let me do the dishes and stuff like that. So,
And then
I have a question for both of you, dude. If you don't mind. So this is going to be a theme that I'd like to bring up a couple of times. What is the film telling us? What is the actual stance the film is taking? And I think when I recommended this film to both of you, I said it was an incredibly disturbing film. It was a technically fantastic film. I mean, we should just quickly mention the color, the cinematography, beautiful. The direction, the acting, just every technical part of this movie is stupendous. Like whoa, blowing away level of filmmaking.
Yes.
But the frustrating part for me was that I felt that, I'm okay with a film introducing concept and ideas and not taking a clear stance. That's all right. But I felt it was taking a clear stance, but it did it incredibly badly and incompetently. And I wanted to try, since you're the two most intelligent people, except for my wife that I know, what you thought about this, because also you're coming from different perspectives, right? So let me just start out with one, and I'll bring up three more things later in our discussion, but just starting out now, she has been set up for, I don't know, 2/3 of the movie as being super intelligent, like off the scale. And maybe that intelligence is because she's the Empress of Andromedan. But also she could be like just really an intelligent human. In fact, there's the implication that, you know, she went to top school. She got her MBA. She's like, you know, yeah, she's a relatively young woman, but she's CEO of a company. You know, I mean, that's a big deal to be CEO. And I don't know how Emma Stone is, but I think she's still in her 30s, right? So, like, that's a big deal, right?
In the movie, she's supposedly 45.
Yeah, and I don't believe that. Yeah.
That's what they said.
Yeah. I mean, she's actually 45 million years old, but, you know, she doesn't look a day over 50. But, you know, so there's one point there. And this is my question to you. Okay. Shibboleth.
Yes.
I can't get past. Yeah, well, that's it. So there's a point. I've bought the plot so far, and I'm thinking, well, you know, she is going to be revealed to be an alien. I do know that. I'm looking for signs and clues, you know, just like The Sixth Sense. You know, you go back and you go, oh, gosh, yeah, there were clues that he was actually dead, and I just didn't see them. And he uses the word shibboleth, but pronounces it shibboleth.
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she says that that's bad grammar.
Yeah.
It's not bad grammar.
It's not bad grammar.
Yeah. It's just him using a different pronunciation. You could say it's a wrong pronunciation, but like, I don't know, maybe people in Newfoundland pronounce it shibboleth. I'm not going to say, you know, but she makes such a huge deal of that.
Yeah.
And I was saying to myself, now, wait a minute. Wherever she went to school, she's really good at language, and she knows what the word grammar means. So why is she getting this wrong? Is that a hint that no matter how educated she is, no matter how much time she spent among us, she's an alien, and so she stumbles on the little things?
Yeah.
Right? Like, and I have a quick reference in World War II, you know, there was this thing about like German spies, Germans have trouble pronouncing J, you know, or something like that. So,
or like in Inglourious Bastards, where they say count to three and they do one, two, three. And they're like, if you were German, you would have done it like that. You would have done
exactly.
It with your numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was a little puzzled at that. Like, was that a reveal? And I'll mention some other ones, but I just, did you feel like it sounds like both of you are in the camp of like a human probably wouldn't keep it together as long as she does. Is that correct?
Well, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Joe. I've already said, I think she, a real human being would have, especially after the electric torture thing, would have cracked by then, you know, I mean, but she's like still like arguing and it's go ahead Julie.
For me it, all the way up until she finds his experiments, I believed she's still human. That was the only moment where she asked how many were in Dromedans. She asked that. That was the moment that I doubted that she was human. But I thought she was human all the way up until that, because we already have one example of a person on the spectrum in this film. And to me, her level of intelligence and corporate speak is also just another way of autism expressing itself. It's just a more socially acceptable way. And so I thought we were going to get to see like a comparison of, you know, when you have the resources versus when you don't, it's still the same kind of argument where it's a top down conspiracy theory, which is still it. I mean, that's ultimately what it still ends up being. But it's just a different take on it. And so that's what I thought all the way up until she said, how many were Andromedans?
Yeah.
And that was when I was like, so she is an alien.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, you sort of raised a good point about, you know, is she on the spectrum, but kind of on the other side of the spectrum, or, you know, corporations are people. Can they also be autistic, right?
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, for sure. I mean, she represents, you know, but people keep talking about, you know, the late stage capitalism. Like there's a scene where she's trying to, with Teddy trying to, again, you know, gain his confidence and stuff like that. And she's telling Teddy that, you know, because they have hurt her mother so bad. And her mother is currently in a coma that she does not appear she's ever going to get out of. And they gave her some kind of settlement. But now she's trying to convince Teddy that they will give her even, they'll give him even more money. And I think to myself, you know, like, you know, I'm going to get personal, but like, you know, if God forbid everything happened to my daughter, you know, if a corporation gave me, you know, $10 million, $20 million, you can't replace.
Yeah, that doesn't replace human life or the experiences you're missing out on or.
Exactly.
Or anything like that.
So, yeah. So.
If all of that is true, isn't it problematic that from the very beginning, this is something else that threw me. Okay, so the Andromedans are evil from his perspective.
Right.
Yeah. We all agree, right? Like he
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
They're doing
he
bad.
Said,
they're
he
destroying
says they're
the
evil.
Bees.
Yes.
Yeah, they're evil. And yet, what is his goal? His goal is, and I'd like you to take me to the ship where I can negotiate on behalf of Earth.
Yes.
With the Emperor of the Andromedans. And I'm thinking, like, if you think they're evil, why? It's sort of like negotiating with Hitler in 1940. You know, I was just writing something on this. And by 1939, when Britain and France declared that, you know, they would go to war if Poland was invaded, most British politicians, even the ones who were appeasers, said, you know, we tried to avoid war, but you just can't make a deal with Hitler. Yeah. Even if you wanted to make a deal, Hitler cannot be trusted. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's something some people need to remember that. But anyway, the point being that how can he simultaneously say the Andromedans are these horrible evil creatures that are doing all this terrible damage and that he thinks they will honor, you know, they'll take him into the mothership and treat him, you know, give him a lobster buffet or whatever, and then he will. I mean, it's a level of delusion that even seems greater than his conspiracy theory. It contradicts his conspiracy theory.
Well, I mean, that again, that's also classic conspiracy theorists that, you know, that they are, because they have seen what other people have not seen. They do, or what was it? That effect where, you know, less you know, more you think you're an expert on something.
Dunning-Kruger.
Dunning-Kruger. Thank you. So
and this was a reference to, you mentioned Heaven's Gate, because I mean, I think that, I mean, I don't know the complete theology of Heaven's Gate, but they did believe that they would be transported to an alien ship that was entering the solar system. So that's a known cultural reference there.
Exactly. So I think, again, it's sort of, again, it's that Dunning-Kruger effect that they're sort of demonstrating, that you know, that Teddy just thinks because he has seen, I think he says at one point he's standing on the shoulder of giants.
Exactly. Thought that was so funny.
Exactly. Which is like, which of Newton said, you know, I think it's like, so they, someone wrote a letter to Newton, right? How did you figure this out? And he's like, you know, I kind of basically sort of said, oh, I was, you know, I was standing on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, interpreted to be humility. Other people sort of suggested that because his calculus was based on this other guy's research, and this guy was really short. So he did not like this guy. So I think it was like a sick burn that, you know, calling him a giant, you know, he was really just standing on the shoulders of this puny guy. But again, it's again, the arrogance of conspiracy theorists who think they, right, you know, that, you know, that they, they're the ones who, you know, the workers of light who are going to be the ones who save the planet, right?
Right.
Yeah. So I'm going to say now, right. So there's this side plot with the cop. Casey. Yeah, Casey. Casey. And you know, at some point, he's going to be the one who's going to kind of like almost crack the case. But, you know, he's going to get a shovel. You know, he's going to get his head cut off with a shovel, you know, like, again, that's pretty stereotypical, you know, these sorts of movies. But they throw in, and I'm going to throw this to the both of you. What was his actual role in this movie? I mean, because he's a cop now, but he was once Teddy's babysitter and he, you know, he SA'd him as a child, and so he's just, you know, these fucking creepy as all get out guy who's coming now almost back to Teddy to beg forgiveness,
and is still
at the exact wrong time too, you know,
and still using his position of power to get what he wants out of Teddy by being like, oh, is that cake, and
yes.
That just those little things, and it's like you haven't changed.
That's a good point.
It continues to make Teddy more and more empathetic to us. Like we're more and more able to like. It's harder to forgive the corporate evil the more that we see like how much Teddy has suffered because of all of these systems of power. Mm-hmm. And all of that. So
that's a good point.
I think I've said that I think technically in every way this is a brilliant film, but I feel that there's just some flaws in the screenplay. And I think this is one of them. He could have been cut out completely.
Exactly.
And you wouldn't have noticed. He could have been a Columbo-like a bumbling cop who is actually pretty sharp at, let's rewind a second. It is hard today to have these kind of plots because you think like, wait a minute, let's go back to that Mercedes. Okay. They didn't just kidnap her. They kidnapped her in the Mercedes. And like, have you noticed in modern cars, every once in a while, it'll say, I want to send data to, you know, Toyota, and you decline, and it still says, well, we're still going to send some data.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So like every modern car, and I guarantee you a $200,000 Mercedes has essentially a black box.
Oh,
that's pinging.
Exactly.
So like the idea that they would have kidnapped her in the car and that there would have been, and also that she had no cameras at her house.
That was also weird.
Corporate CEO.
Right, yeah.
And there was no plan. Like she just assumed we've just gone through a national kidnapping or whatever it was of this poor woman, Nancy Guthrie, which, you know, apparently whoever did it was on a camera, but was ready for the cameras and took out the cameras. I mean, just that plot doesn't work anymore.
You can
go up to almost anybody's house. And not be on camera, and you can kidnap a Mercedes, and nobody traces it, you know, to exactly where it is. So that was some of these flaws, which I kept wondering: was that intentional? Was that something to do with the Andromedan plot or something like that? Did the Andromedans turn off? I was almost wondering, like the police would find the Mercedes and go, like, that's weird. It's not emitting any signals. Or there'd be some cops talking about like, yeah, we tried to trace a Mercedes. Well, because Andromedans don't want to be traced. So they turn off. I mean, I kept thinking there would be something there, but they don't do that. This is where it sort of frustrates the film. Another, you know, number three of how it frustrated me sometimes.
Yeah. Those small details can, they had stood out to me at the time, but I had been willing to forgive them because of all of the other fun and good things.
Well, I was going to say that there's a great scene where they're, you know, the spaghetti dinner scene, and they get into an argument over the cause of colony collapse disorder, and Michelle, and it is a classic debate between a conspiracy theorist and someone who has the facts, right? And she's trying to give him the facts. and he's just like waving it away, and then she, I don't know if that was with the shibboleth thing, that was earlier. Okay, but she does that too, where again, sometimes when you know there's an argument, you can derail the argument by just picking on someone's grammar. Man, your grammar is shit, you know, kind of thing. I thought that was sort of very classic, you know.
Yeah. No, I liked that it was that whole conversation between them was you could feel the tension rising.
Yeah.
She's clearly, this is where I still feel like she's human, because it feels more like she's still just toying with him. Mm-hmm. Like this is all just silly fantasy. But I don't think this is not yet when she says you're mentally ill yet. Cause I know that's what sets him off, and then the whole twists on whenever they're in their little fight and she says, I'm a winner and you'll always be a loser.
Yes, exactly.
That was human.
There's one point too where she exclaims, and again I'm gonna swear here, where she swears Jesus fucking Christ. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get into that shortly, where she does this big long explication, but she's clever enough to basically tell Teddy, you know, hey, your mom's in a coma. You know, I've got the cure with me for your mom. Oh, okay. So just go back to my G-Wagon. And then there's a bottle of antifreeze. It's not antifreeze. And this is where, again, idiot plot, David, where it's like, Ted, you know, it's not antifreeze. It's the cure. Now, this is very smart of her. And then Teddy takes it to the nursing home. You know, puts it in his mother's, you know, a drip. And then IV. And then, she dies. But the nurses don't come and arrest Teddy. Teddy's able to escape and come back. And while he's gone,
covered in blood, comes into the hospital covered in blood.
Yes. I know. Yeah. But this now gets him out of the house, where then she explores the basement and she finds his dungeon of horrors. And again, deep down, we think no one wants to explore the basement of any conspiracy theorist, right? Like, man, I don't want to look in your basement, you know, but right. And we can see at this point, right, because they hint at this has not been Teddy's first rodeo with a space alien. And then they find, right, he's tortured people, dissected them, and he's, you know, and this is where too, he apparently, I think he gets, he's probably already talked to a couple Andromedans before he tortures them to death. And they've given him basically a good idea what the spaceship looks like, because he's got a model of a spaceship.
He gives a couple of clues throughout his talking with Michelle that there's a couple of lines where he's like, they always lie, but then they always confess. And there's a couple of things that allude to that, so we know that he has by the end of the movie, we know that he has talked to at least two Andromedans. So
yes, exactly. So,
this is one of those things where we could insert another movie here. Let's go back to what Julie just said. You can imagine that Gestapo or KGB torturer said, in the end, they always confess, you know, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've heard that line from, and we know that line actually exists in reality for evil torturers there.
Exactly.
Going back to that reveal, which again was just, which was disturbing to me. It's interesting. I'm easily disturbed, apparently. I was really disturbed by that scene. But then I also thought, now, wait a minute. You know, the Canadian embassy knows where all Canadians are in Dubai.
Right.
And if a Canadian goes missing in Dubai, you know, they know. Are you telling me the Andromedans? Three or four or five Andromedans. And by the way, we're intentionally mispronouncing it here because they do yes. that. She does that in the film. And that, again, one of those inexplicable things to me. But anyway, you're telling me the Andromedans, haven't noticed
yeah.
that some of their...
I didn't
follow that. Was that explained and I missed? The Empress doesn't know that, Andromedans have gone missing?
I kind of feel like there was kind of a bit of a whole subplot we haven't really introduced where there's a lunar eclipse coming and they keep having a countdown.
Oh, yeah.
One day, 2 days before the lunar eclipse,
right.
One day before the lunar eclipse. But the font was so screwed up. I didn't know that was lunar. I'm like, does that say custard? I don't know what it's saying, right? But yeah. but it's meanwhile too, it's a flat earth. Again,
yeah.
You got to have the flat earth conspiracy in there someplace, right? You know, so it's like the title card, you know, 2 weeks later, you know, it's a flat earth. So during the lunar eclipse, you know, it's almost like that's when the veil between, you know, it can be, it is where the ship can now make contact or something. So to me, I felt like that was the gimmick, right? That the because when she eventually teleports back to the ship, it's not like, you know, like a transporter, you know, it's like she emerges from this goop as
yeah.
if, you know, she was born into another dimension or something, you know. So
there's a whole theme of rebirth that happens mm-hmm. throughout the film, from the bees at the very beginning to
yes.
the bees at the end. But then, I think so now if the ship can only be accessed in that lunar eclipse, it makes more sense to me
yeah.
now why she rushed out of the ambulance.
Yes. Exactly.
That's why she had to hurry and get back to there.
Exactly. But the scene was, so Teddy comes back, he's killed his mom, you know, he's got his little yeah. shotgun, you know, he's going to make her pay. And then that's the moment where you're like, oh, you definitely know
creation story.
Yeah. So she gives this whole, and this is the part I'm like,
oh yeah,
it was interesting, but it was
this
weak.
Is the most insane part.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Did she think of this while she was in the in between all of these times where they're coming in and out to interview and torture her? Is this the story that she's making up?
Yeah. Well, I think this is the real story, but it reminded me, I don't know if you ever watched the Battlestar Galactica series, but the Sci-Fi Channel kind of lopped off one season. They're like, no, you got it. You meant to do it in 5, you got to do it in 4. So they had to kind of compress the whole season down into the one guy explaining where all the robots came from. And you're sitting there and you're just like, it's a fascinating story, but it's a huge info dump. And it's the same thing here where she's like, the Andromedans discover this world. They explore it. It's the time of the dinosaurs. They accidentally kill the dinosaurs with a virus. They create human beings. They all live together on Atlantis. The human beings decide they want to be better than the Andromedans, so they want to be gods like them. Again, there's so much symbolism there. They kind of create, then they try to create a master race of humans that, and then there's a war between them, and it's nuclear war. The humans are able to survive on an ark, and then apparently then they... Yeah, exactly. And then they somehow, it's kind of like they die off and the only humans left are very corrupt ape-like creatures, which then evolve into the humans we all know and love today, us. And they are...
Well, Can I interrupt? I'm sorry, Carl. This is I actually wrote it down.
Okay.
Because I was so frustrated by this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, this is okay. Quiet. And I'll tell you why it is I resemble a human. Our 75th emperor first discovered the Earth. This planet was ruled by dinosaurs, magnificent creatures with a complex but stable ecosystem. But we inadvertently spread a fatal virus to the planet. The emperor was struck with guilt watching all of Earth's creatures perish. So he gave new life to this planet, life resembling us. The early test humans could barely stand, but soon they walked and began to reproduce. Now, let's remember earlier, it's been set up that they are making a decision about whether to wipe out humans.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the case for the prosecution of humans is that we have ignored the science. You know, even though we know the science about climate change, we've ignored it. That's one of the leading evil things that we've done.
Yeah.
That we deserve to be wiped out.
Right.
And then I thought, like, wait a minute. This speech is pure nonsense. Like you're saying that it's like the people who argue sometimes that evolution didn't happen, but all the fossils were planted there to test us or something.
Right, yeah,
I mean, really, it's just every biologist, every museum, every physicist, every astronomer in all of human history is dead wrong.
Yeah.
Including all my colleagues, you know, who are astronomers and biologists. It's absolute nonsense. And I'm thinking, why did they do that? I mean, they could have had something more plausible that, you know, the Andromedans did this. And I mean, even Prometheus was slightly more plausible than this. This is just sheer lunacy.
Yeah.
But apparently it's the truth. And I didn't know what the point there was. Can someone explain it to me?
Go ahead, Julie.
Oh, I guess it's just because we're still questioning at this point in the film if she's really an alien or if she's human. And, I guess she's maybe we're not supposed to believe it at all. And that's supposed to make Teddy look more and more a not credible person, an unreliable narrator and all of that.
Yes. Well, I think that's just more of trying to get some more touch points with conspiracy culture, because this is now it's Graham Hancock kind of stuff about Atlanteans and, you know, and the idea of like aliens have seeded us and you know, we are really, you know, the corrupt experiment of, you know, aliens and that kind of stuff. So as it reveals, like, their now job is to try and fix us, remove this evil destructive gene within us, and it's not working kind of thing. But yeah, so big long explication, and your mind is just racing to keep up, and you're seeing all the little touch points and stuff. And then eventually she's like, okay, you got to get me back to my office, and I got a teleporter in my office. I can get you up to the alien ship. And he's like, okay. So and that's kind of funny, because they kind of like
just implicitly, you know, trusts her at this point. And
exactly. Exactly. So there's been this massive manhunt apparently for her, and then she just kind of shows up again back at the office. And, hey, Bob, can you just buzz me in? And I mean, they're kind of flummoxed, but again, this happens from time to time. You know, a CEO will just disappear and, you know, reappear, you know. And so anyway, so she comes back, she gets him to his office, they barricade in the office. And now this is the part where you begin to go, no, she's human, because I think she's just playing a long game. So she's just trying to like stall him before, you know, the cops can come, because, you know, he's got himself, you know, a gun and could pop her any time. And she's going to want to wait till the real cops come in and not like, you know, Dolores down and accounting with her stapler that she can chuck at him. Right. You know,
right.
kind of thing. Right. So, yeah. So she's like, okay, this closet over here is my teleporter. And he opens the door and it's just, it's her little,
she gets out an old calculator.
Yes, from exactly. Julie, you're aging, David and I. That did not look like an old calculator. That just looked old like that looked like normal calculator. Okay, but yeah, she claims that the calculator is her teleporter device to initiate it, and she's got to punch in like a 50 number code again. Punch it in real slow to delay him. And then the teleporter is like a closet. And she's got all her little power suits and shoes and everything in there. And he just he shows he's got a bomb, a suicide bomber thing attached. And that he is going to, you know, and that's his insurance.
Yeah.
And so she gets him in the closet. She pushed, you know, and she's like,
I ask you guys a question here? Sorry.
Yeah.
I read another plot possibility was okay. That the whole thing about negotiating and I want to meet the emperor
right
was a false story. What he wanted to do was get close to the emperor with a bomb
and just kill him. That makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense too. Yeah. Cause he does tell her it's kind of insurance, but you're right. It just may be him trying to, you know, take him out, which would make a lot more sense, right? Than like,
right,
you know, in the I'm heroic narrative of himself, right? That yeah. he's gonna stop the threat to Earth,
yeah,
personally,
exactly. Yeah, so she gets in the closet and then closes it, and then she, you know, she presses enter on the calculator, and then he blows up,
yeah. What we're led to believe is that he accidentally triggered it himself.
Yes.
But and, I want to okay. go ahead.
I was going to say, and then they got to render her unconscious.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
So the way they render, not because like the shockwave from a bomb going off in her closet, his head comes flying out, knocks her out. It hits her and knocks her out.
I think we've convinced people that this isn't a family movie, that, you know, this is not bring the whole family.
You warned me at least three times in text, like, don't have children in the room when you're watching this.
I'm not going to show this to my students at any point.
Exactly, yeah. So she gets... They get her in an ambulance. She wakes up in the ambulance and she's like, she's got to get back to her teleporter. And she gets out of the ambulance. She gets to the teleporter. Boom. And that's like, you're really like, no, she really is an alien. Gets back to her alien ship. You find out she's the emperor. And they're doing a little bit of an assessment about how well the experiments are going. And then she decides... the humans are hopeless, and then you can see the flat Earth model, and you're left to wonder, is that really our planet, or is that just a model, you know? And then she kind of pokes it with something, and then the firmament evaporates, and then everybody dies on Earth all at the same time, except all the animals are alive. The end.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so let's go back to Pluribus for a minute.
All right.
That's what I kept thinking about.
Yeah, I said, wait a minute. No. Again, I get this is where the film was very frustrating, because now billions of animals are going to die horrible deaths.
Yeah.
Because they're dependent on humans. I mean, I'm actually angry now whenever there's this plot of like, well, if the humans disappear, you know, all life will be very, I can understand that there is a Chernobyl situation of like, you know,
exactly.
Life is thriving, you know, without humans in Chernobyl, but like the way they do it,
yeah,
you gotta at least relocate the hamsters, you know, and
yeah,
Well, that
that house cat.
Yeah,
he can't open cans.
He's not getting out, right? He can live off the corpses in the house for a while,
but only for so long.
Yeah, exactly. That plot device really bothers
me. Impossible lover.
Yeah.
But this was a film, as you said at the beginning, Carl and Julie. This film checked every single possible box of conspiracy theory.
Well done there.
Yeah.
It didn't.
Go ahead, Julie.
But without like dismissing it entirely, like it makes some parts of the conspiracy theorist be far more empathetic and more believable. But I mean, you still have a lot of the over the top ridiculousness.
Well, I mean, the one thing that sort of, it's like David Icke, right? I mean, this is classic kind of David Icke too, right? You know, that they, you know, the space, they're really space aliens. The leaders of the world are really space aliens. Again, very David Icke. And, you know, and they're, you know, they are basically, you know, cannibals and pedophiles and stuff like that. And, you know, as it's turning out, David Icke was wrong. It's like a, you know, clock is right, stop clock is right twice a day. David Icke was wrong about something, but, you know, but he was also able to kind of piece together all these people that know all these famous British people are telling me the same story, that, you know, they were being abused as kids, and, you know, he was able to kind of see that there was a big mass of, among, you know, the right and the left, they're all connected through this one guy who's not even the most important man on earth. He's just this little short guy who liked to embroider his initials on his hoodie. Well,
and that's like part of the horror, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
these movies talk about, like, they present these ideas to us in ways that seem like, oh, we would never be that stupid. But then we look about what's happening these days, and that's the horror. We know, we do know what's happening. We do, and the system's continuing anyway.
There's one good thing where he shows her the bomb, and David, we are of a certain age where this where this phrase turned and became, went from kind of, was a bit of a backhanded compliment to, you know, much more of an insult, where she says to him, "You're a credit to your species," right? You know, so I mean, back in the 70s, it would be like, you know, "You are a credit to your race." And as if, you know, white people talking to, you know, a black person, as if that was, I'm giving them a real compliment. But what they're really, you know, but it's not a compliment. But, you know, so yeah, I that was very interesting that they borrowed that double thing. Speech. Yeah. And at one point, she calls him. She calls him a sick ape.
Yes. I thought that was like the most. That was the moment where you could see like real contempt, and he could feel it.
Yes, exactly.
Feel that
exactly. But which again, that were again another touch point. Buckaroo Banzai Across the Ninth Dimension, or whatever that movie was. There's a scene where one of the characters, or maybe I'm getting it mixed up with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, one of the characters is telling, you know, one of the space aliens is like, you know, "Don't destroy Earth," and the guy's like, "It's not my planet, monkey boy." just to remind him that, you know, he looks human, but it's of no importance to him, this planet or something.
Yeah.
I feel like there's, as Buckaroo Banzai.
I reminded me of in The Matrix, where it, I've seen it a long time ago. It's Agent Smith, right?
Right.
That mm-hmm. Elrond from the Lord of the Rings.
That's some range in that actor,
that's
right?
In the same universe, by the way. There's conspiracy theory. Lord of the Rings and Matrix are in the same universe. Where there's a moment, and I'm forgetting in which film. I'm assuming it's in the original film because I think that's the film I've watched more than once, where he takes off his glasses and he says to the Keanu Reeves Yale character, you know, it's sort of personal. You guys, I can't stand the stink of you. I mean, it's not just business. I really hate humans, you know? And I think that's very interesting how you mentioned the men who fell to Earth and the day the Earth stood still. There's all this question of like these aliens, they come, they live among us, and sometimes they come away going like, yeah, you know, human beings, they've done a lot of bad things, but there's a certain nobility and they've done good things. And then sometimes they live among us and they go like, God, I hate you people. I just, you know, you
virus
apes. Yeah. Which, yes. You know, I guess for them is like, it's a huge insult. Well, it's a very interesting trope that like has been used differently, you know, like it flips from film to film.
Well, there's a sort of a scene with Teddy's with his woman coworker who has cut her hand and he tells her like, kind of like, it's not going to be a problem anymore soon, right? He kind of foreshadows, right? You know, like, you know, meaning, you know, we're all going to be dead. So, you know, like, it's not going to be, ain't going to be anybody's problem. But Michelle, now the you know, emperor of the universe or whatever, again, she is as guilty as them, right? You know, she,
that's what I kept thinking. It's like, how can you kill 7 billion people without seeing how horrible that is? Like,
exactly. You know, she sits in judgment of humanity when she was exposed to the same temptations and succumbed to all of them herself. And then, mm-hmm. you know, she didn't drive an EV, right? She drove an expensive gas guzzling, throw another, you know, panda on the fire and get that thing, you know, up to warp speed or something. But it made me wonder, her decision to destroy all of humanity, you know, if Teddy had been nicer to her, was she killing humanity because she was just being at this point now vindictive, you know, like, you know, one of yous, you know, cut attack me off. You know, now I'm going to hate everybody in Audi for the rest of my life because that one guy in the Audi that cut me off. And this is actually true for me. I don't like Audi drivers. Sorry, David, if you drive an Audi, but or Julie, I don't know what the pay scales there are at your university, but if either of you were driving Audis, one, can I get a job there? Two, I apologize if I'm making fun of you, but
not at all.
So what do you, David? What do you think? Did she kill humanity because Teddy was bad to her, or did she just realize there was no saving Earthlings?
I know we have to wrap things up, so that I'll consider this to be my wrap up statement.
All right. Okay.
Emma Stone, at the very beginning of this podcast, I talked about Emma Stone is an amazing actress with a tremendous range. And obviously, that's always a benefit to a movie to cast tremendously accomplished actors and actresses. Sometimes I wonder whether it gets in the way of actually understanding what's going on, because she infused that part with so many layers of complexity mm-hmm. that sometimes I wondered whether it was just great acting or whether there was something intentional there, right? Yeah. Like she, when she pokes the flat Earth atmosphere and then, you know, cut to all humans are killed, it certainly looks from the point of view of, like, if she was a human, that she is expressing something between vindictiveness and regret and, like,
there's some sadness,
loss or sadness. And I just honestly don't know whether that was just Emma Stone's great acting or, like, we're supposed to read that there or not.
Yeah.
But that's a conspiracy theory, right? So
I liked that. I felt Emma Stone was really incredible here. I felt like the whole premise of the, like, yes, there were a few plot holes and whatnot that were made took us out of the moment every now and then, but I felt like it really showed contemporary conspiracy thinking really well. We can see these mechanisms of power. We feel that there are things wrong. But we have so much that's wrapped up in euphemism that it's all tangled together. There's like no single thread to pull. And so that makes all of this far more unsettling than any kind of hidden agenda. But so the double speak was always like, that was the thing that stood out to me the most in this, throughout the whole movie. Especially even as it tries to, not necessarily belittle conspiracy thinking, but definitely, give it an archetype and give it a sense of comedy. But the real cruel person the whole time is the corporate doublespeak, yeah. The alien doublespeak.
At end of the day, again, I think they did a kind of a good job of sort of saying that a lot of conspiracy theories are right about some things, but for the wrong reasons, you know? You know, and if you can kind of just not, you can kind of shave off the crazy, you could get your message out much better. All right. Okay. I guess we could wrap that up. All right. All right. David, Julie, thank you. Thank you again for coming on. Again, this is not a trend, but if there's obviously something does pop up again that is, you know, media conspiracy, that kind of thing, you know, we'll reconvene.
Yeah, if you're having fun, I'm having fun. So
for sure, yeah. And again, Julie, you know, if you ever want to come on solo, you know, you've got a favorite conspiracy and you wanna talk about it, you're always welcome.
I'll end up if you ever have the time, you should watch the docuseries Hellier. It's more about paranormal. There's still conspiracy that's threaded in there, and it's right. I think it's fun.
I wouldn't mind if you want to come on and talk about that, because I mean I've heard a lot about that, but it's I got stuff to do. You know,
oh so yeah,
it'd be kind of good to learn more about that.
Absolutely.
Great. All right. Have a good night, both of you.
You too. Thank you so Take much. Care.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Upon those Mission.